Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Monday, July 3rd, 2017. Rebel leader Riek Machar refused to meet the members of the National Dialogue Steering Committee.
Well, maybe Riek Machar was not prepared for a meeting at this time. Yeah, because I don't know actually why he did not meet them. And I think he was not interested in meeting right now.
And some local non-profit organizations say it's not safe to operate in South Sudan.
It is hard because we don't have the resources, for example, for evacuation. You don't have money to charter flights, for example, in case of any emergency issue. Or you don't have the contact with the right people at the decision-making levels.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Some members of the National Dialogue Steering Committee traveled to South Africa for a meeting with rebel leader Riek Machar to find out how Machar thinks the national dialogue should proceed. But the SPLM-IO leader did not meet the group. Michael Atit has the story for VOA from Juba.
Alfred Taban, a spokesman for the National Dialogue Steering Committee, says for whatever reason, Riek Machar refused to meet with the National Delegation Steering Committee.
Well, maybe Riek Machar was not prepared for a meeting at this time, because I don't know actually why he did not meet them. And I think he was not interested in meeting right now.
The steering committee wrote to Machar several days ago requesting a meeting with him in South Africa. In a letter obtained by South Sudan in Focus, Machar replied to the committee that it was more important for the government to immediately end the fighting than to meet with him for talks about the national dialogue. Lam Paul Gabriel, the SPLM-IO DBT military spokesperson, says the government is trying to tarnish Machar's image by sending the steering committee to South Africa under the pretense of meeting with Machar, even though Machar had already informed them he had no intention of meeting with the members. Speaking by phone from Kampala, Gabriel says he does not understand why the committee insisted on going ahead with a trip to South Africa.
What the government wants is to portray a negative image of Dr. Riek Machar, that he doesn't want to attend to the national dialogue. That's why he doesn't want he refused to meet them. But how do you go when you already have the answer that this is not going to happen? What is very important is the priority right now is the peace agreement.
Gabriel insists that the SPLM-IO will not participate in the national dialogue until the government fully implements the 2015 peace agreement. Taban says even though Machar declined to meet the delegation, he reiterated that the two sides exchanged letters.
The national dialogue delegation went to South Africa and wrote to Riek Machar about the national dialogue. And Riek Machar actually replied. He said, for the time being, he thinks the agreement he signed with the government in 2015 is the priority now, not the national dialogue. He did not reject the national dialogue, but he said the peace agreement should come first.
Taban says, despite failing to meet Machar in South Africa face to face, the steering committee remains optimistic.
That exchange of letters was exchange of opinions. And what we are doing in the national dialogue is sounding the opinions of figures, political figures, and the citizens of this country about how to bring peace. So he has already given his opinion about the next step, which to him is the peace agreement.
Taban says another committee is in the Sudanese capital, Khartoum, to meet with Lamakol and other opposition leaders before they depart to Addis Ababa to meet with opposition Thomas Shirilo. He says some committees will also meet with opposition figures in neighboring Uganda and Kenya and will visit refugee camps. Taban believes many South Sudanese citizens have a lot to say about the dialogue process and says those ideas should be expressed to help bring practical solutions to South Sudan's problems. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
Local lawmakers and a community leader from Yei River State's Morobo County are condemning recent fighting between government forces and rebel fighters that left an unknown number of people dead, including a local church leader and two of his children. Lawmakers are demanding that the state authorities investigate the killings. Tito Justin has more for VOA from Juba.
The attacks last Thursday has devastated the area, according to Morobo County officials and at least one community leader. Morobo County lawmaker Kenyi Abiaza John says he was in touch with the eyewitnesses of the attack, who told him Reverend Isaiah Lobida and at least two of his family members were murdered.
The son and the grandson were the ones who were killed outside the house. And then for him and his wife, good enough, the wife was under the bed. And this assailant, after killing the son and the grandson, they knocked the window. And so as a member of parliament representing the people on the ground, I am sorry to say that Archdeacon was killed in cold blood.
Last week, Morobo County Commissioner Richard Remo Soro, who resides in Kaya town near the South Sudan-Uganda border, said only rebels were killed in the attack. John says people in Morobo who have not fled the area are trapped, and he says it's difficult for humanitarian agencies and authorities to reach Morobo County due to the ongoing fighting.
Once the people hear that there is a bit of peace, the roads are open, they will come to centers where they can be assisted. At the moment, of course, they are trapped in the bushes. They are living in the bushes with fear.
James Lasu, leader of the Morobo County community in Juba, has condemned the killing of innocent civilians. He is calling on the government to track down and apprehend the killers immediately.
Government must take the action according to the law in their hands, because they have lawyers, they have what? They have the counselors to call those people, and then to ask what does things happen like this? Who must be responsible? Who sent those people? This is the government hands.
Yei River MP Maka Mustafa, who represents Morobo County, says she's deeply concerned about the plight of her constituents, who she says have suffered greatly since fighting broke out in the area a year ago. Mustafa says it's not safe to travel on the Yei Morobo Kaya Road or other roads because of rebel fighters operating in the area. She says the only way to stop the fighting is to sit down and talk.
Everything should be brought forward on the table so that we discuss it and get solution to that, because there are many things happening. But only we said let peace prevails, all dialogues should be brought forward to the table, then people discuss. It's like 21 years. Something has not happened just like that. People sat down, negotiated, and peace prevailed.
The fragile peace agreement signed recently by the Yei River State authorities and a breakaway faction of the SPLA-IO to restore peace in Yei appears to have completely collapsed. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Juba.
South Sudanese non-governmental organizations say they are vulnerable to security threats because they cannot afford to evacuate their workers or provide adequate security to them should violence break out where they operate. Local aid groups also say they cannot reach hundreds of thousands of civilians who are in dire need of humanitarian assistance because of insecurity and a lack of resources. Nabil Biagio reports for VOA from Juba.
A dozen aid workers have been killed in South Sudan since the beginning of the year. In March, seven aid workers with the Grassroots Empowerment and Development Organization were killed in an ambush as they headed to Bibor in newly created Boma State. The United Nations says a total of 79 aid workers, mostly South Sudanese nationals, have been killed in various conflict areas since South Sudan's conflict erupted in 2013. Nyorgole Valsun works for the Grassroots Relief and Development Agency. His NGO provides relief food to IDPs in former Unity and Jungle states, as well as in Mundri of former Western Equatoria state. He says aid workers from local NGOs are easy targets when fighting breaks out in areas where he works.
Some of the people who work in those national NGOs come from the areas where the activities are taking place, and sometimes the different factions of the opposition or government seem to target them, maybe based on their ethnicity or based on allegation maybe that they are supporting one side or the other.
Valson says being a local NGO worker in South Sudan is dangerous in certain areas.
It is hard because we don't have the resources. For example, for evacuation, you don't have money to charter flights, for example, in case of any emergency issue. Or you don't have the contact with the right people at the decision-making levels.
Valson says international aid workers are usually better off because they have ample resources and have good contacts at the United Nations Security Council, the African Union and other bodies that can provide protection. Adala Joseph heads a local NGO called Citizens Action for Peace and Development with offices in Juba and Maridi. He says, as a small organization, he often worries about the safety of his workers.
What do we do in case of a security threat or something? There is a lot about unknown gunmen. If they come in a way between our ground workers and our office in Maridi, how do we cross those people over?
Richard Gitau is a child protection manager at the Children Foundation Center. He says his organization has devised a plan to establish a community radio station in Bantu that would educate parents on child protection and child education. But due to rampant insecurity in Bantu, his organization has not been able to help citizens in need.
The biggest challenge now has been the security situation, because putting up a community radio in areas that are not secure, it's not possible. So, because of the security situation, it's not possible to be on the ground to do that kind of work. So the project has been put on hold until when peace prevails.
Bonjuri Peter Lado is the team leader of Humanitarian Aid Workers Consortium, an alliance of 25 local NGOs. Lado says local NGOs operating in South Sudan find themselves in harm's way on a daily basis.
Working with these organizations, we have particularly we face threats, you know, in your work as a, as an organization. One of our sister organizations sent a lawyer to Nimule and he was shot on the way.
Valson says the warring parties on all sides must stop targeting aid workers.
The government has a role to do something to deter those threats against NGO, but also the other opposition groups, the armed groups in the country, because they also control territory. So I think they also have a role to do.
Valson says aid workers should also be more cautious and work together to share information about best practices on security matters. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, we take a look at how climate change is affecting Africa. That story is coming up right after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what core value do you live by?
I do value my education a lot, because I know that with education I can go anywhere. I can explore the world. I can be whoever I want to be. I can go anywhere. I can do anything I want in life.
I live by the hard working as the core value, and prioritizing the priorities. I like it just because when I live in hard working, I know for sure one day I might achieve something which I need in life.
It's respect. I love to be respected, and I love to respect other people.
Okay, trust. So I love, like, someone I can trust. So I want someone to trust me, because that's the way to go. Because if you don't trust someone, then there's nothing, there's no way you can go forward with it.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
The European Union has pledged to support Italy as it continues to admit thousands of immigrants across every day from North Africa to the Mediterranean Sea. Italy has threatened to shut its ports to foreign registered boats carrying migrants. So far this year, close to 80,000 people have made the journey and over 2,000 have died. Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
Most of the tens of thousands of people plucked from the Mediterranean this week have been taken to ports on the Italian coast. They are severely dehydrated, usually malnourished, and suffering from infections and skin diseases. Marcella Cray of Doctors Without Borders spoke to VOA via Skype from the group's rescue ship Aquarius as it disembarked over 1,000 migrants at the Italian port of Corigliano Calabro.
We also see the results of people actually being physically assaulted, sexually assaulted, tortured.
Italy's representative to the European Union has warned the situation is unsustainable and threatened to stop vessels of other countries from bringing migrants to its ports. Cray sympathises with Italy's position.
We have not in any way formally informed of this by the Italian government. My first impression of this is that the main thing is that it's actually a cry for help coming from the Italian government. And it would be actually good for other EU member states to take a bit more responsibility.
EU Migration Commissioner Dimitris Avramopoulos offered Italy his support.
Italy is under huge pressure, and we're not going to leave this country alone.
Italy is obliged to take in the migrants, says refugee law expert Professor Jeff Gilbert of the University of Essex, also via Skype.
The law of the sea, international refugee law and international human rights law are all coming into play together. Italy has the right to protect its own borders. While I have a lot of sympathy for the Italian situation, I do not believe Italy can send back boats, even boats that are seaworthy, on into the Mediterranean.
Gilbert says Rome is likely trying to force the implementation of the 2015 EU agreement to share refugees across the bloc, which has so far made little progress. This week, more than 400 migrants in Italy clashed with police at the French border, demanding to be allowed through. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Scientists say Africa's Sahel region has some of the most explosive storms on the planet, often causing flooding and disease due to poor sanitation. A new study says climate change has led to the number of extreme storms to triple in the last 35 years. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
Rising global temperatures are melting ice caps and glaciers. At the same time, they're heating the oceans, causing them to expand and rise. A Cornell University study says that's bad news for those living along coastlines over the next 80 years or so. In fact, it's bad news for just about everybody. It says coastal residents will be displaced, and they'll have a difficult time finding new places to live. Study lead author Charles Geisler is Professor Emeritus of Development Sociology. He says seas will rise fast, but not affect all regions at the same time in the same way.
It's not going to be a slow creep. It's going to come in large pulses. We're going to get storms that are irregular, more and more typhoons, tornadoes, hurricanes, onshore battering, if you will.
To make matters worse, he says, there'll be major ocean surges.
You could almost call them tidal wave effects. Moving that water inland, it's going to put salt in aquifers. It's going to salinize the most fertile lands on the planet, which are those of deltas and low-elevation coastal zones. And it's going to wreak havoc on real estate and structures, infrastructure, much of which is also concentrated on coastal zones.
Geisler says there'll be a lot less land available for a growing world population. It's expected to reach at least 9 billion by 2050. What's more, popular beach and recreation areas will be submerged. President Trump could be directly affected by the coming changes at Mar-a-Lago, a Trump company beach resort and club.
Our current president is among the many people living in South Florida, which is probably the most at-risk place outside of Louisiana and the Mississippi Delta in the United States.
In the past, President Trump has called climate change a hoax and more recently announced the U.S. will pull out of the Paris Climate Agreement. Professor Geisler lists some of the areas outside the U.S. threatened by rising seas.
Bangladesh is the poster child of sea level rise. It's basically a country that is entirely on a delta, and that delta is being lost rather rapidly. The same is true of the Mekong Delta, the southern third of Vietnam. 18 million people inhabit the Mekong, and they're going to have to move inland probably over the course of the next 80 years, I would say a century, possibly a century and a half.
The Chinese coast is very vulnerable, not just because of sea level rise, but also because of what Geisler calls subsidence. It occurs when land caves in as groundwater is depleted.
All along the Chinese coast, there are major metropolitan developments. They are drawing down their groundwater, sometimes reducing the surface of the land by as much as 18 to 20 feet. So you've got an additional serious situation, and that'll be true in other parts of the world. But Asia is going to be hit first and hardest.
In Africa, a vitally important region could also succumb to sea rise.
The Nile Delta is going to be hit extremely hard and has heavy population concentration, unlike much of the rest of Africa.
Some island nations are also at risk of submerging. Geisler says one country that's been holding back the sea for centuries, the Netherlands, is already hard at work getting ready for the next challenge. As the oceans encroach on land over the next 80 years or so, people will look to resettle inland. But the Cornell University study warns of resettlement roadblocks.
There's all kinds of them. Think about war. For the last 200 years, there have been 300 wars of record and many that are not recorded. War is pretty much an ongoing condition on the planet, and we can shrug and say that's human nature, or we can say, oh my God, that actually makes a lot of inland landscapes uninhabitable, at least on a temporary basis.
Wars can leave land contaminated, such as with the defoliant Agent Orange in Vietnam, or landmines in Cambodia, Angola, and Mozambique. Wars can also exhaust natural resources. Other resettlement blocks include desertification, urban sprawl, private gated communities that bar outsiders, and expanding highways. Two of the major ways to deal with rising oceans are sea barriers, giant walls to protect cities like New York, and national relocation strategies. Officials in four counties in the U.S. state of Florida are working together to develop plans now. But Professor Geisler says that ultimately, the answer lies in reducing and holding the line on greenhouse gas emissions, fueling the rise in temperatures. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
A South African opposition member of parliament says the speaker is once again putting the interests of the ruling African National Congress Party above the overall interests of the country. The main opposition Democratic Alliance Party requested a no-confidence vote in response to President Jacob Zuma's unpopular decision in March this year to fire his finance minister and reshuffle the cabinet. James Selfie is a member of the parliament from the Democratic Alliance Party. He says while his party does not mind waiting for another week, such postponement is not in the interest of democracy.
We asked for this vote of no confidence some time ago, in fact in April, and so another week or so is not going to make much difference. But what we find disturbing is that once more the interests of the ANC are being put ahead of those of the country. The reason why it has been postponed is to allow the South African cabinet to have a breakaway meeting. And we don't think that that is in the interests of democracy. We think that it is a very, very important vote that we are taking that may affect the very future of this country. And for it to be postponed because there's a meeting of the cabinet seems to me completely trivial and demeaning to the task at hand.
You mentioned the African National Congress. The party is saying to its members to stand with President Zuma. To vote otherwise will be suicidal. Is this a kind of threat or what?
Well, it's always been a highly disciplined, highly centralized organization. And for that reason, I imagine that if they discovered that people had actually voted against the party line, there might be very severe consequences, including deaths, or certainly death threats. That is why we expect to speak to determine that this would be by way of a secret ballot. The Constitutional Court has opened the way for that to happen. We do believe that in this particular case, there are compelling reasons why a secret ballot would be justified. And then if a secret ballot does in fact get ordered, it may well be that substantial numbers of the governing party would break the party line and vote for the opposition.
You know, I was reading that President Jacob Zuma has so far survived 4 no-confidence votes. So I'm wondering, why push for this one? If he survived 4, do you think he might survive this one?
It's in fact more than that. This is the 8th no-confidence vote that he is facing. And he has survived the others largely because of party discipline and the fact that the votes have been open votes. Now, there may be very good reasons for having an open vote in the sort of electoral system that we have, but in this particular instance, this is a person who was found by the Constitutional Court to have broken his oath of office. He is facing the reinstitution of 783 charges of fraud, theft, money laundering, and racketeering. This is not a person that should be president of our country. And yet he manages to survive merely because he's got an iron grasp over the party that he leads. We take the view that he should allow a secret ballot to take place, and then the members of the ruling party who are as disgusted as we are at his behavior, way that he's run this country, would have the opportunity openly, freely, to express their point of view.
Are you hopeful or are you confident that if there's a secret ballot, that there are enough people within the ANC who are willing to break rank and vote with the opposition?
No, I'm not confident, and I certainly won't count my chickens before they hatch. But what I am saying is that a secret ballot does give dissatisfied members of the ANC the opportunity to vote with their consciences and not with any fear of repercussions from the ruling party.
That's James Safi, a member of South Africa's parliament from the main opposition Democratic Alliance Party. He was speaking with VOA's James Batty from Cape Town earlier today. And that brings us to the end of our show for this Monday. We now leave you with the song Zawaj Ghali by Sultan Clinton. Susanna, Sultanin, Bijan 3, champion. Madame Taisim, Susanna, in a guinea sawa. Mudar Basena, Samana Kazawaja, Madame Taitana, Uroa Pibeto, Montali Abutonati. Oh, Dunia, Anabila Mulusu. Oh, Madame Taifutu.
Rushkan Martha. Zawaja mafi fitini.
Anagini dugu telefon tabeto mo. Anagumurua fibeta butongo. Kalita derushono. Anakeli mugale. Anaderu Susanna tai. Aina na pegarena. Oh oh. Anakeli mugurush mafi. Zawaja diga gali. Anabamuru shunu. Oh mama. Urusha makifaya. Maradero ana. Abuto kali kalama. Anabamuru shunu.
We have been listening to Sultan Clinton with the song Zawaj Ghali. I am John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.